All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are live. Welcome, everybody. It's the first show of the week. We are live on many platforms today. Oh, that's not me there. Why does my webcam do this? One moment, please, guys. We're gonna get that fixed. For some reason, every now and then, we get an empty chair as my webcam. So let's fix that. There we go. That's better. Okay, I don't know what's causing that. I'll have to get that figured out. That's a weird little occurrence that's been happening a little bit often lately. So let's move this over a little bit. All right, it's better. Welcome, everybody. It's the first show of the week. It is Tuesday. We're live on many different platforms today. We're live on GTV. We are live on Odyssey. We are live on Twitter, and we are live on Speak Free Radio. So welcome, everybody, from all the different platforms, the various platforms. I have a question for everybody before we get started on the show. Can you guys hear the outside noise? I have my windows open because it's very hot today, and I'm wearing quite a bit of clothing. Are you guys able to hear the outside noise? If so, I'll close the windows. I'll deal with the heat. Otherwise, while we get started up, welcome everyone. Again, it is the first show of the week. We are doing our typical little two-hour Tuesday with Speak Free Radio. So welcome to everybody that's on Speak Free Radio. Don't forget, if you guys do want visuals over on Speak Free Radio and you want to physically see what's going on, you can now see on Twitter, on Odyssey, and on GTV. You guys can watch visually and follow along. We're going to be doing another philosophy stream today. I've got a nice video from Sagru that we're going to do. A couple people are saying no, a couple people are saying yes. Okay. So since we got half and half, I'm going to close one window. I'm going to close the one that's close to me, and we'll see if that gets better. So it seems that if cars aren't going by, it's probably not too bad. But once the cars start going by, I think it's going to get worse. So there we go. We're dropping stuff. Okay. All right. Hopefully that's okay. We'll see if that's suitable. It's already better for me. I think it's just the one window, this one that's close to me. So welcome everybody. I see we got a lot of people in here already. We've got a good 15 people over on Odyssey. We've got some people on GTV already, and we got a couple people on Twitter as well. And hopefully, we don't have a chat room on Speak Free Radio, but hopefully there's some people on Speak Free Radio that are also following along. So, as usual, because it is a, yeah, you know what? It's actually distracting the hell out of me. I guess I'm just gonna sweat my ass off today. That's how we're gonna do this. It got hot out of nowhere, like really bad today. So I'm just gonna sweat. We'll deal with it. Got a sports coat on, so you guys won't see the sweat stains. We'll be careful here. I'll close the windows. That'll make it a little bit better. Oh, you know what? I'm not live on Entropy yet. Let me do that really quickly. We're also live on Entropy. No one really watches on Entropy. That's mostly just for support, but I will go live on Entropy in case anybody wants to watch over there. There might be the one odd person that really prefers to watch via Entropy. Okay. Anyways,
Already,
we've got a good
I knew
15
that was
people.
gonna happen.
Okay. Anyways, we are live on many different platforms, and we're doing a podcast type stream today. It's gonna be more audible than visual, but there will be visuals. We're gonna have Michael Sagru going on in the background. He's gonna be discussing. Today, we're actually gonna talk about the Bible and Western culture, and we're gonna talk about Nietzsche a lot in this. Socrates will come up. It's a very good discussion. And I'll be contributing my thoughts as well as usual. So it's going to be a very philosophical stream, something that I know Odyssey has very much been enjoying the audience over there. And hopefully all the other audiences will enjoy it as well. Thank you. I'll say hello to a couple people since we got so many in here. Yids, welcome. Waffen, welcome, my friend. Northern Blue, we got Ketzer in here, Full Fingers. Ethno-nationalists, we got Rights for Whites, Randall, Agent Honeypot, and FAMRU. I'm just gonna spell it out because I think I'm supposed to be pronouncing that, but I can't. So, welcome everybody. It's good to have everybody in here. It's the first show of the week. We got a lot of shows coming up this week, a lot of interesting things going on. So, let me actually lay that out right now while we're sitting here. Let's go over the schedule. Okay, so today obviously is the Speak Free Radio show. We're just doing more of a kind of a mostly like a podcast, right? V Lunk, welcome as well, brother. Welcome. It's more of like a podcast type of show. So we always do these on Tuesdays. Every Tuesday, we do a little 5 to 7 show for 2 hours. Main reason for that is on Speak Free Radio. So if you guys don't already follow Speak Free Radio, it's a free speech platform owned by my good friend Dave Gahary, a brilliant guy and someone who's been working in this movement for a couple decades now. So definitely a person to support his work. So make sure you guys go ahead and check out speakfreeradio.com. There's a lot of other good creators on there, not just myself. And you can also find Dave's, he owns a publishing company at moneytreepublishing.com. You guys can go get some really good truth-ridden books over on moneytreepublishing.com. A couple really good ones. I'm actually, I believe they have The International Jew by Henry Ford, which is a very interesting and a book of antiquity, right? I definitely want to pick that up myself. Palestine, welcome. Phoenix, welcome, my friend. Got a lot of new chatters in the GTV. Welcome, guys. Although, Phoenix, I feel like I've seen you as a new chatter like 100 times. That's very odd. Okay. Tomorrow, we have a very interesting show. I think this is going to be something different. We'll be joined by Frank De Silva. So, one in the chat, if you guys know who Frank De Silva is. Two, if you do not. One, if you know Frank De Silva. Two, if you don't. Junker, welcome, welcome. And for those listening on Speak Free Radio, if you guys do want to participate in the chat rooms, don't forget we're on Twitter, Odyssey, and GTV. Logos Revealed on GTV and Odyssey, and it's at Logos Revealed I on Twitter. There's an I at the end of it. Okay, we got ones, we got twos, we got a healthy mixture. Okay, wow, interesting. Okay, so Frank De Silva he's been in this movement for, as far as I can tell, quite a few decades. Very smart guy, well-rounded, and has a very good understanding of things. Definitely is on the same wavelength as me. Really likes to super analyze things, go very in depth, and kind of dig down to the surface of the truth. So Frank De Silva will be joining us tomorrow on my show at 4 p.m. Eastern. We're going to be talking about leadership tomorrow, which is a really interesting and important topic. We're going to be deciding, kind of checking off some of the boxes that describe what exactly it is that constitutes as leadership material in this movement. Because I feel we have an issue in our movement where many people have a hard time creating a difference between who is a leader and who is a speaker for our people, right? There can be many people that are speaking on behalf of the movement. Just to give an example, somebody like Lucas Gage, for example, he speaks our message, he gets that message out there on broad scale, but he does not have aspirations to be leader, right? Or have leadership material. He might not check all of those boxes. So we're going to kind of describe to the audience what those boxes are, and then allow the audience to check those boxes off for themselves. So that's going to be a really interesting collaboration stream. There's going to be a lot of really intellectual thoughts going back and forth. I think people are really going to enjoy that. Mike, I see you over in the Twitter. Welcome, my friend. Welcome. I definitely think it's going to be something worth watching. So that's tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern. The broad topic is leadership. I think in the very beginning of the show, I know Frank clarified he really doesn't want this to be an interview, so it's not going to be an interview, but I might ask Frank a couple questions to kind of give some background on himself, because I know a lot of my main audience, specifically on Odyssey and GTV, are not really familiar with Frank, so I think it's very important that people know the background of the person they're hearing things from, right? It's like you don't want to hear a stranger tell you how the world works, so I might ask that a little bit. Klasha, welcome. I see you in here, brother. Okay, continuing on with the schedule. On Thursday, which is the 4th, I'm sorry, the 11th. I'm looking at the first week of the month. The 11th, Thursday the 11th, we'll be joining Paul Allen and I believe his name is Dalton. They host a show called No Holds Barred on Twitter. It's via Twitter Spaces. So I will be joining that. I won't actually be streaming that myself. I'll just be joining it. I'll be physically participating. And that's at 7:45 p.m. Eastern, so you guys can watch that there. I actually have to update something on my schedule here. That should be an interesting show, something that's very different for me. We have a little bit of a different worldview, so it'd be nice to kind of express our worldviews to each other, and hopefully it doesn't turn hostile. Okay, so Friday we have two shows going on. We're going on with G-Man at 1 p.m. Eastern, as usual. And then we'll also be doing a stream myself at 6 p.m. Eastern on my own behalf. So we got two shows going on Friday. And then Sunday, we're going to be going live at 7 p.m. Eastern. Sunday is going to be an interesting stream. It's going to be something different. Well, not different, but something we haven't done in a while. On Sunday, we're going to be doing a movie analysis stream. So we've done these quite a few times. Obviously, if you guys are watching on Twitter, you've never seen that before, since this is my second Twitter stream. But a few times, we've watched, for example, we watched the movie Hollywoodism, which goes deep into the Jewish control of Hollywood, explains all of the roles that they've played in Hollywood, how they founded Hollywood, how they shaped American culture through Hollywood, in their own words. So we'll watch a different movie. I have one actually in mind. I'm actually going to wait to tell you guys the title of the movie. We'll discuss that on Sunday. Very subversive. We'll explain the subversion. Obviously, there's a lot of Jewish roles in this movie, both in the creator, the producer, and the actors. And it's, again, shaping that American culture, as they call it. So I'll definitely make sure we cover that movie pretty well. V Supremacist, welcome. I see you over there. Maybe next time. Hello. And bored all day. Hello, my friend. Nice to see you in here. I haven't seen you in quite a bit. Okay, that's the stream schedule for this week. Nothing else special going on yet. We have other things going on next week, but I'll explain that once next week comes. I don't want to get like way too far in advance. Otherwise, people are just going to forget what's going on, and we're going to kind of lose track. Don't forget also, if you guys are not already participating, to join the book club. Book club is, we've been hosting for, I think, 5 or 6 months at this point. No, definitely not American Pie, although that is a very subversive movie. Not American Pie, though. That's actually too subversive. I don't even want to watch it. It's nonsense. It's disgusting. So the book we're reading this month is Agricola and Germani. It's actually two books in one. This is by Tacitus. Very interesting read. I'm actually already halfway through. I read the Agricola, or Agricola, rather. And I will be reading Germania very shortly here. But this is the book for April. If you guys want to join the book club, it's hosted through Telegram. All you have to do is send me a private message on Twitter, Gab, Telegram, whatever you choose. Again, you can find me at Logos Revealed on all. The only one that's different is Twitter. There's just an I at the end of Logos Revealed. But you guys can join the book club. It's free to do so. We are strict on participation. That's the only thing I'm going to say in advance. We're very strict on participation. So if you aren't able to keep up with us and you aren't able to read one book a month and just write a simple one-page report on the book so that we know you're participating, don't join the club, because you're going to end up getting removed. It's not a rude thing. It's not like we hate you if we're removing you. It's just we really want people participating. If you're not participating, it kind of defeats the purpose of having the book club. But this is the book for the month. This month, we're about a week and a half in, roughly. We've got many more books laid out for the rest of this year. Those are all posted up on my Gab profile, again, at Logos Revealed. You can find all of them there. Bored all day, that's okay. So here's the thing. If you're unable to participate in the book club and you can't meet the requirements, that's fine. If you come in and you try and you're unable to do it, we're a little bit lenient on that, as long as we see a fair and genuine effort. And if you still aren't able to fully make it, that's no big deal. We'll kindly say, hey, you know, if you can make it in the future and you want to join back, you're welcome to do so. But we're going to remove you now, just because, you know, we just don't want blank people kind of sitting in there anonymously, not doing anything, not participating, not being a part of the club. The whole idea of the book club is to create community. It's to create a sense of relationship between ourselves based upon our culture. So we're creating a relationship around our culture, which is something very important, right? Culture in modern society Well, specifically Aryan or white culture in history is very heavily frowned upon or ignored, rather. It's not. It's frowned upon by foreigners and ignored by our own people. So we're going to make sure to really focus heavily on that culture, discuss that culture, and create a relationship and a community around that. Something that is you're not going to find anywhere, which is why I really recommend you push yourself to join the book club, right? It's not an easy thing to do, maybe. Some months the books might be a little bit long. It might be a bit of a challenge. Take that challenge. That's what makes you a better man. You know, this is something you're not, you can't go to your local library. You can't go on Facebook and join a book club like this. It's a one-of-a-kind book club where we're reading, it is esoteric literature, although it should not be, but it is considered esoteric. Not many people have read these things, and they're not something you can just go to Barnes & Noble and buy, right? So it's essentially a diamond in the rough. Make sure you pick up on that. It's a very valuable thing, and I really don't want people to miss out on it. So definitely get yourself in and participate. All right, Bordel, I hope to see you honing up that behavior and chiseling a better man out of yourself. Definitely put that effort in. You got it. Phoenix, yes. The whole book club is actually hosted through a Telegram channel. So everything is via Telegram. And at the end of the month, when we're finished with the book, we do voice chats. However, you're more than welcome to hop in the book club and put a voice message in the chat. I will certainly put a voice message back, and hopefully we can also have other people participate and do the same. That would be really nice to see. Okay, all right. I think we're gonna get into the show now. We've got a video here. Let me pull this up. Sorry, it's very sunny out today and hot. It's quite the day. Okay, so again, the video we're gonna be watching today and discussing, not just watching, is The Bible and Western Culture. It's called Nietzsche and the Death of God. This is another philosophical analysis by Michael Sugrue. If you guys are not familiar with Michael Sugrue, he's a very intellectual philosopher with a mind that I really would have loved to pick this man's mind. I tried very hard to get him on my show, and unfortunately he has passed away a couple months ago, so he is no longer with us to spread his knowledge. But we'll be playing this video and paying homage to him in the afterlife. So here we go.
No philosopher has had a greater influence on the 20th century than Friedrich Nietzsche. He was a remarkably original thinker.
Folks, please let me know if the audio is okay, all right, if the audio is good. Just make sure he's not speaking way louder than me or way quieter. Just let me know, and I'll try to level it out. I've had a couple people tell me that the audio can be really off on my shows, so just let me know if it is off. And I'll make sure to equalize it as best I can.
Who extrapolates some of the main tendencies of late 19th century Western thought and derives certain extreme and disturbing conclusions from his analysis of the history of Western thought. And he takes a position with regard to religion and theology that is in many respects the inverse of Soren Kierkegaard. Nietzsche is an existentialist thinker, often regarded as one of the seminal thinkers among the existentialists, but he decided to make the other half of the Kierkegaardian choice. He decided not to abandon all to religion, but rather to abandon religion to the tradition of pagan Greco-Roman antiquity. He was the most important thinker in the undermining of theology, particularly in the last 100 years. There is no one who has had a greater influence on the path of Western religion. Now, there are people in the history of the West with whom we might compare him, but fewer as radical as Nietzsche.
Very important to understand the framework here. So for those who don't understand what exactly Nietzsche's goal was when he was creating his philosophy and his thought process and writing out these works, his goal was to take the Christian structure, the Christian version of morality that is present today, and actually demote that and replace it with a more of a racialist mindset, making ourselves out to look towards our culture rather than our religion or our theology. He was very of this world, so to speak, or worldly. Hold on, let me see, we have something in the chat here. Do I think race mixing is an unforgivable sin? Yeah, certainly. Well, let me. It's a very hard question to just answer blandly. It's unforgivable because it's the only sin that is uncurable or unfixable, untemperable, right? So this is well described by Adolf Hitler in some of his speeches. He actually states that the admixture of your blood is the only mistake that cannot be corrected. So if you look, whether it's a theological mistake, a political mistake, a financial mistake, a historical mistake, all these things can over time be amended and fixed. Alteration of the blood is something that humans can't create blood, right? We can't just make a genetic species. So, and if we did, it would be a very scary day when that comes. So it's very important that we recognize that admixture of the blood is the only thing you can't go back on. So whether you want to view it as a sin or not, I do, but whether you want to view it as one or not, that's your choice. But the one thing that stands, whether you view it as an immoral act or a moral one, actually it's impossible to argue that it's a moral one. But if you view it as an immoral act or not, you view it neutrally. The important thing to look at is that it's an action that can never be reverted. You can't fix that action. So say you regret that action after 20 years, 30 years, maybe after four generations. Whenever that time comes, you can't revert that mistake. You cannot go back and change that. It's the only thing that cannot be changed, right? If you have a societal mistake that, you know, society is slowly collapsing because somebody passed this law that's really bad and really destroying our economy, you can go back and you can amend that. You can fix that, right? You cannot amend the alteration of blood. That's something that is infinite and forever, right? It's determined indefinitely. And this is something that Jews recognize probably better than any other race, which is something that you have to pay attention to very carefully. They know wholeheartedly that the alteration of blood is something that you can't change. And again, your culture comes from your blood, right? So this is very important to understand. Whatever your race is, that's what creates culture. That's why even South Koreans and North Koreans have a different culture, and they dislike each other, right? That's why even Japanese and Chinese people have different cultures and dislike each other. They're so closely related, right, genetically, but because they're just slightly different, those cultures have created themselves amongst their own, and if you were to alter the blood, right, let's say, for instance, if Japan became 80% Mexican, right? Well, it wouldn't be Japan anymore. Now it would be Mexico, and it would slowly become Mexican culture in that country over time. It would take a few generations, but that's what would happen. So it's the same for America today, modern day America. We're in a state where, or a country rather, where our situation is, we were predominantly white. We were created as a country that was espousing a white or Aryan culture. And that culture has, the more that others come in and morph the way things work, the less it becomes our culture and the more it becomes theirs. So let me give you a perfect example. We just described this in the very beginning of the show, talking about the movie Hollywoodism. Hollywoodism expresses how Jews create, in their own words, again, this is very key, in their own words, how Jews created Hollywood and started shaping our culture, right? Or shaping what they call American culture. So if American culture was, obviously when America was created, it was all European peoples that founded this nation and created the Constitution, all these things around it. That was the culture, right? So now a Jewish population comes in, makes this thing really popular. All Americans and Europeans start focusing on this, right? So now our culture morphs via Hollywood. Therefore, we're morphing away from a European culture and into a Jewish culture, right? That's very key to understand. And the more we have different races and different populations in our country, the less of our own culture we will have and share, right? Which is, by the way, part of the reason that we have depression skyrocketing and suicide rates going through the roof is because a lot of people today, they don't have an identity, right? Your identity has always been your culture since the dawn of time. And especially, this is very true of Aryan peoples, white peoples. If you look back at our history, our culture has always been our identity, right? If you were a Roman in ancient Rome, Rome was your culture. Being a Roman was your identity, right? If you were a German, being German is your identity, right? So looking into the future now, no one really identifies, I'm not going to say no one, but on the rule, mass of society, they do not identify with their culture. This is where you see people having this identity crisis where they decide, I don't feel comfortable in my own gender. I have to swap over to something else and cut my dick off, right? It's because they have a lack of a sense of identity. They don't feel comfortable anywhere. So they're being now told through Marxist indoctrination that, oh, you know, you're in the wrong gender. That's all. You just have to change your gender and you're going to feel better, or you're going to feel like you have the correct identity. And this is unfortunately something that is working its way into the normality of society and needs to be reverted very fast. Because it's getting a lot worse. Because what you'll see is people who change their gender, thinking that's why they're having that identity crisis, they end up committing suicide. Suicide rates are extremely high among those people. So clearly, that's not the fix. That's not working. That's not fixing the situation for them. All right, let's move forward in the speech here.
In some respects, you might compare him with Machiavelli because he is strictly amoral. He thinks that morality is an impediment to superior men and the superior activities they might undertake. He is also utterly incapable of pity, it would seem, like, say, Callicles in the Gorgias. He wants power. Power is the center of Nietzsche's conception of the world. When we lose theological orientation, when theological insight is denied us, and we are marooned in this world of space and time, there are only greater and lesser quanta of power. We have a greater or lesser capacity to do the things that are truly within the human domain. Nietzsche wants to provoke us to a sort of atheistic heroism which replaces religion with art. It is very clear that this set of philosophical problems is going to be very influential in helping Joyce develop his aesthetic philosophy when he breaks away from religion and intends to substitute art in its place. Now, Nietzsche is often kind of criticized and sometimes praised for being the source of a great deal of 20th century atheism and existentialism, and he's sometimes connected with the Nazi movement, and that, I think, is dicey. It's hard to say whether he was adequately represented as a proto-Nazi or not. But it is certainly the case that he was a hypersensitive individual, and he was a man of extraordinary intellectual gifts. He was a professor of philology who had a tremendous grasp of the classical languages and had them early. He was appointed to his first position as a professor at 24. And in the German-speaking world, where there's only one professor of a given discipline in a university, that is a remarkable and extraordinary achievement. People.
Jack, this is a Michael Sugrue lecture going into the philosophy of Nietzsche, but more so what he's going to start focusing it on. Looking forward, or kind of going further into this video, he's going to start focusing on the Bible and Western culture as well. What's very key to understand, we use this word proto-Nazi, right? Or a prototype of a national socialist. The reason this is used is because Nietzsche held a lot of the same worldviews that National Socialist Germany ended up instilling, right? And this would make sense because this came... This movement of National Socialism spawned from Germany. It spawned from that German psyche, right? So a lot of this was gearing, if you look in the early and late 1800s and into the early 1900s before the rise of Hitler, this was something that was formulating very much in German intellectualism, was this idea that our race should be linked with our faith, right? Our faith should be bound to our race, and we should be... moving our morality more towards what is good for our race as a collective whole. This is a different worldview to the typical Western worldview that was present at the time, and especially of what is present now. And we see the consequences of this. So it's very important, whether you want to agree with these philosophies or not, or decide that they're correct or immoral or whatever you want to call them, the main piece that's really key here is to understand that if we ignore the significance of race, if we don't look at race as a piece that is something to look at intellectually, if we leave race out of the picture, we make the mistake that we're making in society today, where we forget that culture comes from that race. We forget all of these things, and we slowly start to dilute that culture and lose it over time. And if you look at 90% of civilizations in history that have collapsed over time, it's been through a slow process of miscegenation, where they used to have this royal class, that ruling class, that was, what were they? They were hereditary. It was a hereditary monarchy. It was linked to their blood, to their genetics. And they would slowly dilute this and ruin this over time by mixing with the slave classes of society, lowering that IQ, lowering that ability, that understanding, and then losing that cultural trait, right? This is something that we see echoed throughout history. So, and we're seeing it today in the American empire. Synobium, that's okay if you disagree, you're more than welcome to. If you could, when you disagree, just give a reason for doing so, so we can explain and come to a census. And yes, Nietzsche absolutely did hate Christianity, you're correct.
Could not speak highly enough of Friedrich Nietzsche in his early days. Now, while it is true that he was a remarkable scholar, he was, in addition to that, a ferociously honest individual. He did his best, like Kierkegaard, to be an individual. He did his best to sense tremors in the foundation of Western culture that other people couldn't feel. He wasn't perhaps like a seismograph. He could see that there were continental shifts occurring, which would eventually result in an overall arching conflagration, which would generate a sort of intellectual earthquake. He didn't cause this intellectual earthquake any more than a seismograph does. But because he was a particularly poetic and particularly sensitive individual, and because he had an uncannily large and voluminous grasp of the Western tradition, he was able to see the implications of the development of Western thought and the crisis that Western thought had entered into after Darwin. So Nietzsche is in some ways not the cause of what he's talking about. He is the messenger. He is not he doesn't send us the message, he just delivers it to us. And the message that he intends to deliver to us is the following: God is dead, God remains dead, and we have killed him. We should not blame Nietzsche for killing God. What he is trying to say is that Western culture has already killed God by the time he writes that in his book, The Gay Science. In fact, God was killed by the rise of modern natural science and by the progress of people from a barbaric state of mythological interpretations of the world to the more sophisticated state in which they find themselves. This sophisticated state is an advance in culture, but it is a danger to people's moral orientation. As a matter of fact, all moral orientations will be radically changed now, because when God dies, all of our constructs of right and wrong, all of our conceptions of ethics and metaphysics are now thrown by the board.
Okay, so it makes sense, right? We see the death of God in modern society today. He saw it a little bit in advance. We see it today. One thing I do want to push back on here, Bored All Day, he states, there's a lot to discuss here. Bored All Day states, Christianity, let me see where you said that. Sorry, I have so many chats up. Christian values are white values. I have to disagree with this statement, and let me explain why. White people or Aryan peoples prior to the coming of Christianity, before Christianity came to this earth, right? If we look at all of those cultures prior to Christianity, all of them were pagan. And pagan, to clarify, because a lot of people mix this word up and think of this as, they were like some kind of Wiccan, like child sacrifice people that were into witchcraft or things like that. Paganism, let me just clarify, let's not even use the word paganism. They were all polytheistic, okay? They believed in gods, a plurality of gods, right? And then, additionally, all of them had a universal god that was kind of the god that they would refer to as the singular, right? So, for instance, if you would look, there was Zeus, right? Zeus was the god of gods. So that was, he was God, and then under him were gods, right? And what's key to understand is Christianity came after all of those ideas, right? And Christianity is a product of Judaism, and this isn't something that we can refute, right? So if we look at Judaism, for example, Judaism is the first religion or the first ideology to ever come up with the idea that God is one universal being that is all controlling, one and all, right? There's only one thing, one universal thing, and it's just everything, and it's all interconnected, right? This is a Jewish idea, right? And it's not to say that it's Jewish in thought or Jewish in mind. It comes from Jews, right? It's a Jewish idea in its inception, right? So when we come further and we go to Christianity, which preaches the same ideal that God is this universal one thing, right? That's we're taking a Jewish worldview, and we're accepting it as our own. I'm going to show you why this is the case. I'll prove this right now in the chat room. So for those chatting, how many years old do you think the planet is? Type in the chat. How old do you think humans are on this planet? How many years? When do you think the planet started? Humanity specifically. When do you think humanity started on Earth? If you could put a timeline on it. Getting good answers from Odyssey. Getting very good answers from Odyssey, actually. I'm quite impressed. Okay, so anybody who states that they think the world is more than 6,000 years old, you're not a real Christian, right? Because a Christian follows both the Old and the New Testament, right? They follow the Word of God. Well, the Word of God in the Old Testament states that was 6,000 years, right? That's how the Jewish calendar functions. So if we look back at the Jewish calendar, it states that the world is roughly 5,700 years old. That's how old humanity is, right? That's how Jews view things. That's when they find the birth of Adam and Eve, which it goes back a lot further than that. You can get many interpretations. But that's typically what, exactly, full fingers. But that's my point. So here's what you have to understand. I'm gonna express this. So full fingers says, the Old Testament is mostly the Torah. The Torah is Judaism. You're correct, right? But that Judaism got preached from what? The Word of God, right? So the New Testament is Jesus saying, no, I know the Word of God just like you guys said it, right? I follow the same God that you follow. But he said that you guys are not following him appropriately, and I'm here to change that, right? He didn't change the story. He didn't change what God is or what the meaning of all of this is. He changed the morality and the behavior of the peoples under that God, right? So what's very key is Christianity took a Jewish worldview, morphed it for itself, and then applied its own unique, what we would call a white or Aryan morality to it, right? That's the key to understand here. And this is why Jews don't accept Jesus as the Savior, because they disagree with that morality, right? That's where we get this Judeo-Christian values things, right? Judeo-Christian is an oxymoron. They refute each other morally, but worldview-wise, they do not, right? You'll have a lot of Christians that will tell you that the world is 5,000 to 6,000 years old, right? if you don't believe that that's how the Jews think, well, let's look at the year right now on a Jewish calendar. They're in the 5800s, right? They have a completely different calendar than us, and that's when they believe that the world was incepted. That's when things started, right? So when we take a Christian worldview, we have Old Testament, New Testament, right? If you read the Old Testament, it's a set of laws, it's a set of rules, it's a set of all these things, okay? Christianity is, Jesus comes, he says, I don't agree with the behavior of the people, I don't agree with what they're doing, right? But he didn't disagree as to what God was. He didn't disagree as to what the history of the things were, right? He agreed with the prophets of Israel, right? When he looked back at all these things, all he did was apply a new morality. He said, these behaviors, you know, money changing in the temple, behaving immorally towards the people, murdering, he laid out all these sins that Jews were obviously doing at the time, and said, these things are all inextricably incorrect, and I'm going to replace that with a real morality, right? Which I would agree is a white or Aryan morality. The problem is Christian morality over the centuries has heavily changed. It's no longer in the same place as it was all the way back then, right? So back then, they recognized the Jews as a completely foreign and immoral force. Today, it's become so inverted, they actually praise Jews and put them up on a pedestal, right? Not all Christians, obviously, but it's very common, unfortunately, today in modern Christianity. Sonobi, I don't appreciate the attitude, brother. Relax, man. You can disagree without being angry.
If I would change the analogy slightly, you could say that Nietzsche was like a canary in a coal mine. We put the canary down there to see if there's poisonous gas, because it dies much, it is affected by the gas long before people are. Well, Nietzsche, singing at the end of the 19th century, is singing a song of the end of theology, and that means the end of metaphysics, and that means the end of the whole tradition of Western philosophy. In books like Beyond Good and Evil, now there's a title, or The Genealogy of Morals, or The Antichrist, he tried specifically to undermine faith in the Western religious tradition. And in addition to that, he tried to shake up the orientation of Western philosophy and move it away from metaphysics towards this world. He had the same intellectual goal, to make people live in this world and to deprive them of religious illusions which previously had sustained society. He said, look, these are hollow illusions now. If we are going to have illusions, we'll have to make up new ones. The old illusions will not work. Now, this by itself would not have attracted much intellectual attention had Nietzsche not been at the same time the greatest prose poet of the German language. Nietzsche has remarkable poetic gifts as well as remarkable philosophical gifts. That confluence is a very rare thing, and when it is incorporated in a man like Nietzsche, whose will to truth is as ferocious and as tenacious as any of the philosophers we have studied, we will certainly find that the results, like the results for Kierkegaard, are quite volatile and quite dangerous. Nietzsche is at his best when he is sharpening little daggers that he's going to throw at his reader, and he's such a wonderful poet. He says in section 126 of The Gay Science, you may want to turn to that if you ever get a chance to look at the book, it says in section 126, mystical explanations are thought to be profound. In fact, they are not even superficial. Oh my. Oh my. I had to spend a great deal of time removing that from my brain. That was one of the greatest one-liners in the history of philosophy. It's devastating. Whole libraries of theology crumble under the force of that blow. It is a remarkably sharp and pointed and barbed instrument of war.
I just want to explain something, and this is why I never discuss theology in my stream, or very, very rarely, because no matter what, at the end of the day, no one's going to agree, right? It's a pointless thing to actually discuss in depth, because I have a view, you have a view, he has a view, that guy has a view, this person has a view. 80 fucking people can read the Bible and all interpret it in a completely different way. So it's literally impossible to ever come to terms with everybody on theology, and it's a worthless thing to discuss, right? So I'm not going to discuss my pieces on theology anymore. There's just no reason to. I'm going to specifically only talk about Nietzsche's philosophy, and we'll go from there. Because the whole thing, how I view it and how you view it and how this guy views it, we're all going to view it differently at the end of the day. It's never going to change. And there's just no fixing that. Because none of it's fact. None of it is set in stone where this is absolutely how it is and this is the way it is. It's too interpretable. There's no sense in actually discussing this because we can't actually place a logical solution on things. It's just not possible.
Nietzsche is at war with his readers.
It's the only time my chat is in like this great disagreement where everybody is arguing with each other and there's like opposing thoughts all over the place, which shows you that by fact theology is the only thing that's divisive. So it's something we should all just really ignore, set aside, and talk about once we've solved our main problem, which we all recognize. Because in the meantime, if we just sit and talk about these things, it's not productive at all. So again, Synobium, right? What you see as a fact, I could see as a fact. You're misunderstanding. You're misunderstanding, right? Because you can bring your facts on theology to the table, have all of that laid out for yourself, and then another person can go quote the Bible and disagree with you with their quotes of the Bible while you quote your quotes of the Bible and say how they're wrong, and it could just go back and forth all day and you'll never actually come to a solution or a conclusion on the problem. It's an entirely interpretable thing, and you'll never actually, you'll never come to a solution. I will not, I'm sorry, Synobium, I will not come on stream and debate theology. I refuse to debate theology, like I just explained why.
Says no compromise, you must take things seriously for once. Can you see why spiritually he's very much like Kierkegaard? It's just that he's the alter ego of Kierkegaard. He's willing to take one idea the whole way and refuses to make any kind of compromise. I believe that he probably would have liked Kierkegaard's work either or.
So, for instance, Synobium, if we look back in all of our history, okay, all of these different philosophers, Nietzsche, right, we look at anti-Christian philosophers, much like himself, and we look at Christian philosophers that are opposite of him, like Aquinas, right? They all view it completely differently. So how can one of them be right and one of them be wrong? It doesn't make sense, right? Nietzsche has good critiques of Christianity. They have good takes of other things. So at the end of the day, there's just no, you can't come to a conclusion. I don't debate theology. I'll debate anything else with you. You want to debate the Jewish problem, you want to debate racial issues, you want to debate National Socialism, you want to debate the best physical buildup of a political society, I'll discuss anything with you. The only thing I won't debate is theology. I just don't think it's worth discussing, because no matter what, at the end of the day, I'll have my worldview, you'll have your worldview, no one's going to change the way they view things. It just doesn't do anything.
Would have taken the other alternative, the same sort of philosophical radical and the same sort of spiritual, ferocity, spiritual power motivates both men. Now, it may be easier for you to read Nietzsche if we step back a little bit and think about the kind of writing he does. And the best way to do that is to compare Nietzsche with his great philosophical opponent and his great intellectual opponent, Socrates. Nietzsche hated Socrates. He had great respect for Socrates. He said, finally, someone worth talking about and talking to. The problem with Socrates is in many ways the same as the problem with Jesus. The problem with both men is that they generated a metaphysics which led the tradition of Western culture out of the world of space and time. Socrates in the Republic invents the world of the forms, right, where we keep perfect beauty and perfect truth. Jesus has heaven where we keep God and the Holy Spirit and the saints and the martyrs and all that. Nietzsche says, in both cases, the problem here is not the particular dogma that's involved, but rather the whole idea of metaphysics. He says, I have an idea. The world we're in, this is the world, and there's no other world to be in. So let's not talk about metaphysics of the Greek kind or of the Christian kind anymore. Instead, we should adopt a new position. We will love the earth. We will find what is best in this world, and we will do what we can to improve and perfect human possibilities here and now. It's obvious how this is going to be very influential in helping Joyce develop his aesthetic philosophy. Now, The comparison to Socrates goes actually quite a bit deeper than merely professional jealousy. And God knows there's a tremendous amount of that in his railing about Socrates. Socrates' characteristic locution, his characteristic way of communicating to other people, is called irony. Socrates is not remarkable for his literal speech. In fact, he is constantly and opaquely ironic, and many times there are levels to his irony, which is what makes his work inexhaustible, which is why we still read it 25 centuries later. Well, Nietzsche has figured out a similarly neat trick, and it's called not irony, but oxymoron. My argument is that Nietzsche uses oxymoron in the way that Socrates uses irony. Now, for those of you who have forgotten what an oxymoron
is. So, I'm going to let him explain what oxymoron is, and then we'll go into oxymoron a little bit. It's a very important style of discussion or writing.
It's a turn of phrase like cold fire or hot ice. The idea is that we attribute an adjective to a thing that doesn't have that property, has the opposite property. Let me give you some examples from Nietzsche's works. He once said, "What are mankind's truths but his irrefutable errors?" Irrefutable errors? What would that be? Well, that's an oxymoron. The point is that the tradition of Western rationalism has never led us to certainty, has never really led us to anything that could approximate the canons of Platonic knowledge. In fact, the best we can come to knowledge at all, since God is not around to validate our knowledge and the realm of the forms that Plato invented is no longer around to validate our knowledge, the best we're ever going to get is a series of perspectives about the world. And for that reason, what we call truth is in fact the errors we haven't refuted yet.
So, for example, another oxymoron would be an insulting compliment, right? It's an oxymoron. These things do not align with each other, right? They're actually opposites. But although they are opposites, there is still a way that this works, right? So, for instance, if I'm to say to you, I really think it's great that you lost a lot of weight, right? In modern society, we'll more so see this. It's very uncommon amongst normal people. But we see very often today, if someone is to say, "Oh, I see you've lost weight. That's really impressive." You know, someone might take that as, "Oh, you think I'm fat, or you think I was fat," right? So it's an insulting compliment, right? You are trying to compliment, but they're taking it as an insult. And this can be interpreted in many ways. It can go back and forth and the other way around. It's all over the place. But it's a very interesting thing. And Nietzsche writes in this format very frequently. He writes like this many times. You'll see these oxymorons, which, again, it's an oxymoron put into a sentence, right? Put in as a almost... It's almost in itself a philosophical concept. It's very interesting. But you see this a lot in his works. You see this a lot in Will to Power, and Beyond Good and Evil, you see it all the time. It's very common in that work. One thing, what's very important, again, when you discuss philosophers, it's never good to just wholeheartedly agree with somebody all the way through. And one thing I disagree with is Nietzsche's takes on Socrates. I personally do not view Socrates in the same lens that I view Christ. I view them in an entirely different lens. And although Socrates was looking outer worldly, it wasn't wholeheartedly looking to the world after. Instead, it was looking to there was still a sense of being the best in the world here, and then going to something good in the world after. It was a duality of the two. Meanwhile, in this Christian worldview, it's more towards specifically focus on the world after. Nietzsche is specifically focused on the world here, right? So we've got the two polarities. Socrates was almost directly smack in between the two. He was a man who said, well, it's important that we're knowledgeable here, that we're good here, that we're virtuous here, that we're correct here, and not just for what comes after, but just for the betterment of everything around us, right? And then additionally, it might help us for what may come after. And then we speculate on what comes after as well. So it's like he's like this little door wedge in between those two polarizations, where Nietzsche says nothing that's after matters at all. That's its own thing, right? And where Christ says nothing that's here, nothing that's worldly matters. All that matters is the kingdom after, right? So it's two polarized worldviews And then Socrates has more of this middle wedge. So I disagree with Nietzsche's take of kind of putting Socrates in that same camp of the outer worldly. Because there was very much, for instance, Socrates, although wasn't openly stated as such, he was certainly a Stoic thinker, right? Well, Stoicism is very of this world, right? It's how you demean yourself, how you behave in this world, and what is provided around you for this world, right? However, he still thought about the world after. So there was this, again, this duality, this combination of the two ways of thought with him. It wasn't just black and white. It was more grayish with a man like Socrates. Folks, we're coming up on the 1 hour mark. We're going to take a little bit of a 5 minute break here, as we usually do. So thank you guys for everybody that's listening so far. We're just going to take a little five minute break. I'm going to throw you guys some classical music. Hopefully you guys enjoy that and relax. I'm going to take a little bathroom break and fill up my tea here, and we'll continue forward yet again. Give me 1 second. We'll pull this up here. Okay, I will be with you guys shortly. Enjoy. Alrighty, ladies and gentlemen, we are back. Welcome into the second half of the stream. Again, we're doing a Speak Free Radio stream. This is more of a podcast stream than anything else. It's much more audible than visual. So if you guys do want to participate in the visual side of things, make sure you move over to Twitter, Odyssey, or GTV for all my listeners over on Speak Free Radio. Don't forget to follow me on my socials. We've got Gab, Twitter, and Telegram. It's at Logos Revealed on all. And obviously, the Twitter is at Logos Revealed with an I at the end of it. I was unfortunately unable to get the Logos Revealed original at on Twitter. JM, I see you over in the Twitter chat. Payne, welcome. Cauldron over in the Twitter as well, welcome. It's nice to see a couple new people. I see a lot of people on Twitter viewing. I'm not seeing as many chatting. I don't know if that's just on my end or if that's a typical thing on Twitter. Again, I'm very new to the Twitter streams. This is only my second one. I hope you guys are enjoying so far. Last stream was probably a little more entertaining because there was quite a few people on the show. It's hard to really top that up coming into just a one-on-one show with myself. We've got quite a few investments over on Odyssey, so I want to say thank you to the people on Odyssey. Ketzer, with a $25 donation, he says, halftime shekels. Thank you very much, my friend. I appreciate that. Maybe next time, with a $5 and a $3 investment, he says, did Segru say Nietzsche wanted to replace religion with art? If so, please explain this idea. Did he say that? I don't know if he said directly that. I know he wanted to replace religion, certainly. And it wasn't necessarily religion, so to speak, that he was trying to replace. It was more so the modern form of morality, right? Which, again, I'm going to reference back to my other shows that I've done, the podcast shows. We've gone very deep on the subject of modern morality and how Jews have shaped our modern morality into their own morality. Again, you good, buddy? Again, if we look at our morality, our worldview of morality, compared to the Jewish worldview of morality, it's much different, right? Again, just a really base level and simple example. Pedophilia is advocated in their textures, or in their scriptures, in their texts. They openly state that this is an okay thing. We state against this, obviously. There's not a single Western country that advocates pedophilia openly, right? However, you get groups like NAMBLA, which was founded by a Jew, and then you get people like Allen Ginsberg, who was a Jewish poet, who are openly like, hey, you know, I think we should be able to have sex with children, and that should be fine. That's just my kink, my thing, right? Very disgusting, very against our morality, our worldview. But furthermore, Nietzsche's worldview is that morality, again, I've explained this so many times, we'll do it one more time. Nietzsche's worldview is that morality is not black and white, right? There's gray areas. A very good and simple example of this is killing somebody. In a regular morality, we say killing is bad, no discussion. There's no talking about it, right? Well, we might kind of say, okay, well, there's some gray areas, right? Let's say this person has raped and killed 10 children. Is it now okay to execute this guy? Now, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing to do. I don't think it's immoral to kill somebody that would be killing more people, and especially children, right? Innocent people. So Nietzsche's worldview is that it's more gray than that. There's more interpretation than that. And he also states that this idea that might is right, and this is nature, right? And this is a truth, right? At least for all of nature. So to say that humans are different is a bit egotistical, right? It insinuates that we're somehow better than the rest of nature. So, for example, if you look in the desert, right, or in the jungle, where you're in there, that's a different Ginsberg foreplay. I wasn't even talking about that Ginsberg. I was talking about Allen Ginsberg, the Jewish poet. But yes, that's another Jewish Ginsberg who was openly for pedophilia. Yes, unbelievable. So if you look in nature, whether you're in the jungle or the forest or in the ice caps, right, nature states that whatever the strongest is what survives, right? So if you look in Antarctica, right, and there's a polar bear and there's seals and there's penguins, who's going to survive if they get into a situation, right? Whoever is the strongest. But then let's take the breeds out of this, right? Let's take the different species of animals. Let's just say penguins alone. Who's going to survive out of those penguins? Well, the strongest one, right? The one that's most willing to go fight for its food and survive, correct? The problem is, as we become so civilized as a society, we no longer have that survival instinct ground into us, bred into us, right? So in a normal world, when you're born, you instantly have all the survival alarms belled off, right? We got to survive, right? Look at cats, for example. They're more feral cats, like Bengals and cheetahs and lions, and they're really heightened on the survival instinct. They're always prowling. They're always looking for prey, right? Then go look at like a house cat. You know, they still have a little bit of it in them. It's still in there, but for the most part, they're more domesticated, right? And this is what Nietzsche states, is that we have become a domesticated people. And Nietzsche doesn't directly state this, but this is why we can, excuse me, this is why we can refer to him as a proto-Nazi, because the National Socialists stated this openly, that we've become a domesticated people. We are no longer recognizing those natural principles that are present in all other life forms on Earth. Every other life form on Earth, the strongest of its kind survives. And this is true in society, right? The problem is our strength is no longer in our physical might, in our ability to you know, beat something up or you know, throw a spear or shoot a bow. Our strength now is in our intellect, in our wits, right? That's where our strength lies now. How smart are you? How capable are you of navigating the internet, the system, the social media? You know, how capable are you of navigating the stock market, right? Your wits now, your intelligence is now where the strength is, right? Which is a change in dynamic for all of really the world, right? Or all of the natural world, that is. So this is caused by the Industrial Revolution, right? So now we see this progression, and National Socialism refutes this. It says, look, you know, this is a very modern idea, and it's so new, we don't agree with this. We agree with that might is right, and that's true of all other natural beings on this earth, all other nature-driven organisms. So Nietzsche kind of set the precedent for that by saying, like, you know, this isn't just a black and white. There's gray area in here. There's interpretabilities in here. And again, now as this system collapses, just as every other system collapses, you get to this point where we go, okay, you know, let's say tomorrow society collapses, just completely crumbles. Might is right is now going to go back into that physical realm, right? And not just in the intellectual and the above, right? And the problem is, as we get into the intellectual and the above, if we don't have an appropriate moral setup in society for that, then instead of might, like intellectual might overcoming, now cunning overcomes, right? So you can be as intellectual as the person next to you, but if they're willing to be an immoral sleazebag, and, you know, lord over people in a very immoral and degenerate way, they're more likely to get by in modern society, right? Like, in modern society, to have a large place in society, be high up on that societal pedestal, on that social ladder in the modern capitalist world, can anybody get up there without doing some kind of degenerate or immoral act? Is it even possible? Are you able to get to those upper echelons of society without in some way being immoral or being degenerate or being something that we would view as immoral on a collective scale? I don't think it's possible, right? And that's why morality is shaping very heavily as technology gets better and better and things change so much. Morality is being completely changed, but that's the problem. We don't want morality to change. If morality changes, it sets a whole nother historical precedent. We're putting ourselves into an entirely new worldview, and this could be for the worst. Well, so far it already seems like it is for the worst. We've only been in this for, what, 100 years, maybe less? And already we can see how much the morality, that lack of morality, therefore, has changed drastically the functions of society and the happiness of society. So we need to kind of go back to those roots. Okay, I'm going on a tangent. We're going to go back to the video. We're going to continue this. Thank you again, guys, for all the kind investments in the chat. Greatly appreciate that. Don't forget, if you guys do want to support the show, down low on both GTV and Odyssey are all of the links for you guys to support the show. We've got Bitcoin wallets or cryptocurrency wallets. We've got Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Monero. We also have Odyssey. You can support straight through Odyssey. And additionally, on Entropy, you can support through Entropy, and that has live alerts that will come up right here on the screen, and will kind of come up with a live message. So, okay, we're going to continue on the video here. We've got about 45 minutes left of the show.
It means that the drive towards knowledge that we've gotten from both Greece and from Christianity is now being undermined and being devalued. Part of Nietzsche's program, he calls the revaluation of all values, changing the entire tablet of good and evil that had been handed down from generation to generation throughout the Western tradition. He says, I'm going to destroy that tablet and construct a new one. He intends to replace the tradition of Western religion with his own thought. He also, at the same time, intends to abolish the tradition of Western philosophy because he thinks that it needs metaphysics, and once he gets rid of metaphysics, then there will be no more tradition of Western philosophy. In other words, he seriously and literally and honestly thinks that Western philosophy and religion end with him. Now, this is no small estimation of oneself, right? And for a man who in print refers to himself as the Antichrist, you may perhaps get the idea that megalomania has set in somewhere along the line here, and in fact, there's a considerable justice in that sort of a criticism. On the one hand, he is dealing with the greatest of philosophical problems, and in all honesty and in fairness, he is a superior man, a man of superior intellectual merit, and a man of great courage. It is not an easy, it's easy to ignore religion. It is very hard to abolish it. They're quite different. It is one thing to be indifferent to religious questions and another thing to decide to torch them all. This is a very different set of expectations. He is not at all a prosaic writer, and no one reads his books without one way or another being affected. I remember in particular when I first read The Gay Science and I read the passage about God being dead, I had to read it again and again and again. It was one of the most difficult passages I read when I was in college, and to this day, I have never completely made my peace with it. It will repay a very close reading on your part if you ever get to The Gay Science. In the process of reading his works, The Gay Science and the others, always keep in mind this idea of oxymoron. It will make your life so much easier. Instead of trying to tease out some sense out of irrefutable errors, remember that this is Nietzsche's stock in trade. This is what he's good at, because it gives you something provocative to think about without committing him to any logical position. If you go back and try and figure out exactly what Nietzsche does believe, it is not entirely easy to put together. Like many other philosophers, he is better at explaining, or if not explaining, attacking the things he does. Does not like.
So another important piece to understand about Nietzsche, and he openly stated this, he wrote to confuse people. He wasn't writing to just lay out his worldview and his ideology. Much of this was meant for interpretation, meant to kind of think about and delve into and discuss, which is brilliant marketing, if you want to call it that. It's actually quite intelligent. And you'll see this a lot in many of his works. It's very hard to follow his line of thought and see it as this one linear understanding. Many times you'll go, oh, okay, I'm agreeing. Oh, what the hell? What's going on here? And then you have to follow another line and another line, and it'll go all over the place. And Nietzsche is doing this intentionally in his writings.
Then in articulating a defense for the things that he does approve of. He does say that ethics, because it had been previously based upon Christian religion or because it had been based upon metaphysical philosophy, that ethics is over, in the sense that the traditions of right and wrong that had been handed down for the previous 15 or 20 or 25 centuries in the West are now gone. Ethics turns out to be one of these irrefutable errors, and it would seem that for an error that's irrefutable, he is trying very hard to refute it. Remember, though, that Nietzsche, because he is not a philosopher, because he thinks philosophy is over, and is primarily a poet, not a logician, doesn't care if he contradicts himself. Remember that the essence of an oxymoron is a contradictory utterance. Hot fire or hot ice doesn't make any sense. Cold fire doesn't make makes sense, but it is a very moving kind of locution that pushes you in a poetic rather than a logical way. This is what Nietzsche is good at. Now, in abolishing morality, in destroying ethics, he is taking a position very much like that of Raskolnikov in Dostoevsky's great novel, Crime and Punishment. If any of you know that piece, you'll...
Which, by the way, I just want to mention, that will be a piece we're reading in the book club this year. So if you're not in the book club, hop in the book club. All of the books that we've been reading this year interconnect and reference each other and talk to each other and speak to that same philosophy. These are all cultural works. It's very important that you guys join the book club and get read up on all these things. That you can really formulate all of this worldview by having all of these different literatures put into one. It's very interesting.
You'll know that early in the novel, before Raskolnikov comes back to the Christian fold, he commits a murder because he has the theory of the exceptional man, that the usual norms of right and wrong, which we expect to be universal, are only partially complete. There are certain superior individuals, according to Raskolnikov, for whom the traditions of morality do not apply. That's the idea of the exceptional man. Well, Nietzsche, in fact, makes an argument along these lines, that the great world historical individuals, that superior men, do not have to be bound by the constraints of traditional notions of right and wrong. They are the great artists. They are the great creators. And they may be artists in the sense of painters, artists in the sense of literary men, but they are creative in things like politics or things like science as well. From this perspective, from the perspective of Nietzsche, all superior men in every discipline that are breaking the bounds of inherited forms, they are what he means by an artist. The artist is the creative human being, and the creative human being can create in any domain. It doesn't have to be a sculpture or literature or something like that. What he is saying is that that art and that capacity to create is more important than any moral judgment we might make about an artist. An artist may be a wicked man, but if he writes well, then he is a superior individual. It doesn't make any difference whether he obeys the usual rules that we like to impose upon all people. What makes a man great is his willingness to give up that herd morality, as Nietzsche calls it. Nietzsche says that all of our moral systems have been made to satisfy lowest common denominator needs. He looks, for example, at the history of Christianity and says, look, the reason why Christianity was a religion of slaves is because it serves the interests of slaves. If you are a Roman master, as Nietzsche kind of likes and sympathizes with, well, you could do all kinds of cruel and wicked stuff, and because you were superior, you never felt bad about it. You didn't have this nasty religious guilt. What kind of a superior, heroic man would do that? Nietzsche said that all of Western heroism was poisoned by the advent of Christianity because it made superior people develop what he called a conscience. And he thought that was a very bad development because that truncated their ability to act. Who knows what great figures would have done if they had not been kept back and held back by these arbitrary strictures of Christian morality. He once wrote a very telling line. He said, I will never forgive Christianity for what it did to Pascal. Now, if you know Blaise Pascal and his agony over religious questions, he says, look, here we have a superior man. He was a great mathematician and a great scientist. What did you do? You set his own mind against his rational abilities, and you destroyed that man. I would give a million Christians who think that they're going to be saved for one more Blaise Pascal. And then I'd be able to tell him that you need to be liberated from these Christian myths. And when you are, then you will truly be the heroic man you could become. So he has an axe to grind against the entire tradition of Western Christianity. He thinks that it inhibits the growth of individuality and it prevents the growth of heroism. And heroism is what he's all about. He says, look, I don't care about the mass of human beings. He thinks that the mass of human beings, in opposition to Christianity, he thinks that the mass of human beings have no value whatever.
And I want to clarify something as well, which is, this is a really important situation here, okay? So Nietzsche discusses that the mass of human beings is worthless, right? They're valueless. Socrates, in essence, thinks the same thing. Does not describe this, but thinks the same thing, right? Let's go to the first line of the Republic, right? When Socrates says, I'm going down into the town, symbolizing that he's going with the lower level people, right? With the slaves, the peasant types, right? So when he goes down with these people, he quite literally, by stating that it's down, he's saying that these people are lesser than me. They're lower than I am, right? However, he wants to uplift them. He believes it's his moral duty to uplift these people, right? What's really interesting about this is that in that process of uplifting these people, he's looking at them in the light of, I would like them to be better, right? Nietzsche is coming more from a perspective of, I don't think they're capable of being better. And what's really interesting to pick up on why they have maybe that difference of thought is, look at the difference in time, right? It's almost 1800 years of difference between the two ideals, or the two men expressing their ideals. So 1800 years after Socrates, Nietzsche is seeing the same pattern that Socrates complained about trying to fix, and the pattern has not fixed itself yet. No one's been capable of fixing it. So Nietzsche at this point is saying, it's an unfixable pattern. That broad mass, they don't matter, right? Now, again, here is where, if we go into National Socialism, the difference goes boom, and it completely slides off. So as much as Nietzsche had some of the same views as National Socialist Germany, Hitler and the National Socialists thought a lot different in this regard. They said, no, we want to uplift the mass. We agree that the mass, at least of today, is not well off, but we want to help them. We want to turn them to the correct way of thought. We want to educate them to be a better version of themselves, and through this, create a better mass so that there is no negative mass, right? Which is a really interesting dynamic that's, again, very different. So in a sense, when you think about it like that, Hitler is actually more in line with Socrates than he would be with Nietzsche, which is a very interesting comparison to even draw, something that you probably won't hear anyone ever draw ever again, realistically. I see we got another investment. Big and Smalls with a $5 investment. Thank you very much, brother. He says, I'm thoroughly convinced that in our conversations, our outreach, our activism, it's nothing to do with owning anyone, rather with respect and love, that we are uniquely positioned to provide information. Information with which, should they decide to use their intelligence and think for themselves. Yeah, I absolutely agree. Again, the battle that we're fighting right now is particularly an information battle. Things have not progressed themselves into physicalities yet, and you know, we obviously hope they don't do so, but unfortunately, history has shown us that that's very rarely the case. But yeah, we are specifically in a philosophical or spiritual war at the moment. And it's very important that we wake people up as fast as we can before things get far worse than they need to get. Fenderman, in many, many, many ways. And again, much of it you can attribute to that same slave morality that's discussed here, which is, again, a very interesting concept. Yeah, Photonic. They didn't appear to be. They were succeeding. That's the thing people don't realize. You know, you'll get this argument from conservative types quite often, who are very anti-National Socialist. They'll state, "Well, Hitler lost, so his ideas must have sucked." Well, did Hitler lose economically? Did he lose politically? Did he lose intellectually? Or did he lose a physical warfare? Right. It's very important, and the problem is most people only see things in the physical realm. They're very two-dimensional in their way of looking at things. Okay, so they go, oh, he lost, so he sucks, right? That's not how it works, right? So if we look at all of the ways he accomplished, his economy didn't collapse. His people didn't lose faith in him. He didn't intellectually get outsmarted. He wasn't overcome by the morality of others. You know, he wasn't politically ousted by a better running candidate, right? He lost a physical warfare. And this was a physical warfare that, by the way, if anybody won in his circumstance, would be the biggest miracle of human history. Again, Germany is the size of Texas. So I use this analogy very often. Imagine all of America decided tomorrow, we're declaring war on Texas because they're trying to secede from the United States, right? And all of us start pounding on Texas with all our tanks, all our aircrafts, all of our infantry. You think Texas is going to win that? I don't give a shit who the governor is. I don't care if he's the smartest person that's ever existed on Earth. He's not winning that. There's just no physical way. So it's exactly the situation when you look at National Socialist Germany. They were winning in every way possible. The only way they lost was a physical warfare in which they were outnumbered like 1 billion to 1. I mean, the ratio was absurd, right? billion to one's an exaggeration. We could say a couple hundred thousand to one, right? It was an absurd number versus a very small number, okay? However, if you look at, you know, when Germany started to first infiltrate Russia, look at the casualties of Germany compared to the casualties of Russia. It's about tenfold on the side of Russia. In some cases, almost 30-fold, okay? Hundreds of thousands dead, millions captured over in Russia, while maybe a measly 200,000 to 300,000 were dead on the German side. That's very important to understand. Okay, so what do you think is the cause for that? You think it's just because they were only better at physical warfare? Or do you think maybe their fighting spirit was more vigorous? Because that's a really important piece to look at in warfare, right? If you don't give a shit about what you're fighting for, how can you fight well for it, right? When you're in the Soviet Union and the only reason you're fighting that war is because you're scared that if you don't fight that war, you're going to come home and be seen as a coward and Stalin's going to kill your family, your motives aren't in the right place. So you're less likely to have that fighting vigor, you know, to really want to win. You're just fighting for the sake of fighting because you know you have to, right? When on the other side of things, if you're fighting for this grand ideal that you can see and perceive very well in your mind, you have that vigor. I want to win because I want this idea to succeed. I need this to work, right? You're passionate. You have that fire in your soul. That fire was not in the soul of the people of Russia or even America, right? America didn't even want this war. It was only through a grand atrocity propaganda that they were convinced to do so.
The only people who are worth anything are superior people, and I have a strong suspicion that Nietzsche thought he was one of those superior people. Something you should consider in the history of philosophy, whenever someone makes an argument for aristocracy, they always think that they're aristocrats. You never see plebeians making arguments in favor of philosophical aristocracy. If you see an argument in favor of elitism, the speaker thinks he is part of that elite. Without fail, it always works. Now, Nietzsche, strangely enough, would not feel bad about that. He said, yes, of course I'm a member of an elite. I don't buy this Christian equality of all souls. Look, there's no God for us all to be equal in front of, and big fish eat little fish. Some people are better and more capable than others. We just live in the domain of nature. Stop trying to even things out and help the feeble and the incapable and the incapacitated. Help the great people do great things, and to hell with the rest of humanity. It's a radical, courageous, but also slightly immoral, actually not even slightly more, greatly immoral stance. In some ways, what's heroic about Nietzsche is that his immorality is done at the level of Milton's Satan. He will not serve. And there's something strangely attractive about him for that reason. There are times when he comes up with all sorts of repulsive stuff, but I cannot eliminate from my mind a certain sort of admiration for Nietzsche. I would not be a Nietzschean follower. Nietzsche is the sort of philosopher that if you follow him, you are not at all a Nietzschean. Nietzsche wants no followers. As he says, be a man and follow me not. I found my path, you find yours. Anyone who reads all of Nietzsche's books and says, I believe everything Nietzsche told me, understood nothing that he read. The whole point is that he says, go think these problems through for yourself. Like Kierkegaard, he forces you to become an individual. I think it is a good and necessary tonic, but I would worry if anyone came to me and said, after reading this, it seems to me that almost all this is correct. Well, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But the point is, it is stimulating and provocative. We'll give you interesting questions to ask, if not satisfactory answers to those questions. Now,
I want to pick up on something else, just really quickly, a brief little fun fact. You use the term aristocracy. We've heard this term aristocracy quite often. Does anybody know what aristocracy means? The etymology of the word, without looking it up. One in the chat if you know what aristocracy means, two if you do not. One if you know what aristocracy means, two if you have no clue at all. Nope, not inherited, nope. This might come as a surprise to some. Okay, it's a Greek word. So aristocracy comes from the Greek origin aristo and kratos, Aristo, meaning noble or Aryan, okay? And Kratos, meaning ruler or rule of, power, right? So, quite literally, aristocracy, if you want to translate it, you can translate it a few different ways. You could translate it to Aryan power or rule of Aryans, okay? Because again, Aristo means noble, which also Aryan means noble, right? So it's rule by Aryans. It's Aryan power. That is what aristocracy means, okay? Very important that people understand that. Make sure you look into the etymology of that. Aristo is noble or nobility, okay, which is, again, Aryan. And Kratos is rule, rule of, power, okay? So aristocracy, by definition, is Aryan nobility, Aryan rule.
In a piece called The Use and Abuse of History, he gave his conception of what human life was like, and he gave his conception of the value of human life, and amazingly enough, it's not very high. Remember, he is living in the age of Darwin. Darwin has published The Origin of Species, and there's been a great to-do about it, and some people were trying to find some way of splicing Darwin together with the tradition of Western Christianity, and others were trying to say, well, look, we can accept Darwin, but there's no real big change. We can hold on to the essence of Christianity and just give up those silly myths. Nietzsche says, nay, you can do nothing of the kind. Darwin has fundamentally changed our understanding of ourselves, and we can never go back. Darwin has conclusively proven that human beings are a part of nature. They are not part of God's providential plan. There was no such thing as Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. In fact, all we are complicated apes. He looks at the whole history of human beings and at the status of history and says, we're going to have to rewrite our history. And in the future, the universal historian will not start, say, in ancient Babylon or ancient Egypt. Certainly won't start in the Garden of Eden. In the future, the universal historian will start with something on the order of pond scum. You know, that green one-celled stuff that grows on stagnant water? Said, in fact, Darwin has shown that that's what our ancestors are. Like it or not, we're a really complicated version of that green stuff that grows on ponds. Now, the difference between us and that green stuff is that we've somehow gotten the bizarre idea that the entire universe revolves around us. He says, I have an idea. No, it doesn't.
Again, this is very key, and this is another thing in which you can see Nietzsche aligning with National Socialist ideology. National Socialist ideology. George Lincoln Rockwell actually stated this really well. Again, he was maybe a National Socialist after the case, so it's a lot less, holds less weight. But I'm still going to use his phrasing because he represented the worldview quite well. He stated that a National Socialist, as a National Socialist, we look in history, we look at all the different species of the earth, we look at all these different natural organisms, fish, pond scum, rhinos, alligators, tigers, right? And we say, okay, all of them are, that's what they are, right? They can't mix, might is right for all of them, the laws of nature apply to all these animals, but most worldviews say, okay, well, when we come to humans, all of a sudden, those laws don't apply. Well, a National Socialist says, I don't have that kind of an ego. I agree. As a human being, I recognize that we also have to follow those laws of nature. We also are underneath that law, because who gives us that law? Whatever we view God as, whether you think it's one thing or 10 things, or whether you think it's a physical thing or a spiritual concept or atoms in the sky, whatever the hell you think it is, right? That creation, whatever that creating force, that creative forces that created us, if we don't obey that, if we think we're above that, we don't deserve to partake in this world or partake in this world, right? We don't have that privilege, okay? And this is what National Socialist worldview states. It states that, look, and this is why I want to also clarify to people, okay? We have a lot of people that are Christian nationalists. We have a lot of people that are National Socialists. These are two different concepts. We have disagreements in between those two groups. I'm gonna outline where that disagreement lies, okay? That disagreement, to an extent, actually, lies in a miscommunication. So these people will state that faith is above race. National Socialists will state that race is above faith, okay? Now, I'm going to draw this threefold and explain why both are incorrect, okay? God Whatever you view God as, doesn't matter what the hell your worldview is, whatever you view that creative entity in the universe as, that which controls natural law, that is above race. Race comes next. Then comes your faith, because your faith is a product of your culture, okay? Because Buddhists practice one faith. Christians practice another faith. Blacks practice another faith in Africa, okay? Every single person has a different faith. Romans practice their own faith. Greeks had their own faith, right? Your faith is a product of your culture. Your culture is a product of your race. God comes all the way up top. That is number one. Race comes beneath that. And then comes faith, because your faith is a product of your race. Your race is what determines what your faith is, okay? Obviously, in a modern society, this is conglomerated into all kinds of different places, so it's a lot different, and we can argue that, right? In history, on the historical lens, your race is your faith. If you were Roman, your faith was, you followed the Roman gods. If you were Greek, you followed the Greek gods. If you're Jewish, you follow the Jewish god. If you're Christian, you follow the Christian god. If you're Buddhist, if you're Chinese, you follow the Buddhist god. Okay, it goes on and on and on and on and on and on. Okay, so it's God, race, faith. So when we look at Christian nationalists and we look at national socialists, they actually agree. They just don't communicate it appropriately, okay? So national socialists are like, race, 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 race. Race is important. Race, 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 race. So then all the Christian nationalists are like, whoa, 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 wait, 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 wait. God is above race. But they don't word it that way. They say faith is above race. So then the national socialists go, no, you can't put faith above race. Faith comes afterwards. So then that you see where this dispute comes into hand, right? God, race, faith. We don't actually disagree on that. I don't think Christian nationalists or national socialists disagree on that point. They're just not viewing in that lens. National socialists view it in a different lens. Christian nationalists view it in a different lens. And then they argue with each other on the miscommunication of the description of the two. Okay? So it's not that we disagree on worldview. It's that we disagree on how we're explaining the worldview. Right? It's very important. I think everybody would agree with that. God, race, faith. Because faith doesn't... Faith... If you were to use faith as... And this is how Christian nationalists use it. They're using it as a like an all-encompassing term, like faith in a God. Okay, yeah, but the thing is, that's faith in your God, right? So what we're trying to explain is, it's faith in God in general comes before race, then comes the race, and then comes the faith underneath that, because your faith, again, is a product of it, right? It's like we're working down the corporate ladder, and you want to start on a different step. So that's where I think that miscommunication lies is it's God, race, faith in exactly that order, and it can't be viewed in any other order. And then under faith comes state. Okay? Actually, well, no, I'm sorry. It would be God, race, faith, family, state. State, family, state, family, state, family. Family, state. I would argue, so that's where I think it gets interpretable, is state or family. I actually think family would come before state, because family is the foundation of the state, right? Without the family, the state can't exist. So, okay, so I would say it's God, race, faith, family, state. In that order, 5 points, that's the order from top to bottom. All right, let's continue forward. We've got roughly 15 minutes left on the show.
You're a really complicated and really arrogant pond scum that has an entire misapprehension of the nature of the world around you. And once Darwin comes, we can never go back. God is dead. It's just that none of you people have figured that out. And the way in which he introduces that is quite remarkable. He says, look, if we're pond scum, then what are we going to do to find some value here in the world? We have to make choices. We have to make decisions. If we can't do it on the basis of ancient religious myths, what will we do? Even pond scum has to do something. And his answer is the will to power. Nietzsche thinks that he's found a natural motive within all living things. In other words, he thinks it's an exercise in biology. He says the reason why things reproduce and take over a domain or take over a territory, why they compete with other species, is because all of living things, all of organic life, is in fact motivated by the will to power. The will to power in very complicated organic beings like human beings is sublimated and twisted and distorted, but it's the will to power that makes everyone do things. A general conquers a city, it's an expression of the will to power. A scientist finds out about a particular phenomenon. When he does that, that's his will to power. When a saint engages in fasting and mortification of the flesh and discipline of the senses, that is the saint's will to power. Your will to power can be extended to the outside world, but it can also be imposed on oneself. So what he says is that the will to power is the one skeleton key to all of human motivation now that we know what we really are, just complicated animals. Nobody here but just us natural things. Now, this leads us to consider the problem of how Christianity relates to science, which has been a vexing problem throughout the history of Christianity, but particularly as we come to more contemporary authors, it comes more and more to the fore. Strangely enough, Nietzsche adopts a very odd perspective. What he says is that rather than an antagonism between Christianity and science, he says that antagonism is actually quite late. In fact, modern natural science is the intellectual product of Christianity. And that's a remarkable idea. He says that if you look to the roots of modern natural science, you will find that they are contained within biblical religion. Think about the idea, for example, in Genesis chapter 26, verse 28, when human beings are given dominion over the birds and the beasts and the fishes. God told us that we're supposed to push nature around and it's supposed to serve our ends. That is...
Krieger, I don't want to go too deep into this philosophical concept because it'll go for hours, but yes, to say the simple answer, yes.
It's not intuitive, and that is not...
Krieger, it's a shame you weren't in the book club a couple months back. We read Thus Spoke Zarathustra by Nietzsche, which is an incredible book. It doesn't touch on all of his philosophies, but it does a good amount. I would recommend, if you're going to read Nietzsche, I would recommend, in this order, personally, I would recommend you read Beyond Good and Evil. I'm not big on gay science. I don't think it's a great book, but... I would read Beyond Good and Evil, then I would read Thus Spoke Zarathustra, and then I would read The Antichrist. I would read them in that order specifically, personally.
Obvious to every religious tradition. Try explaining to a Buddhist why you want to dominate nature. And they'll just look at you and say, well, why would you want to do that to nature? We want to harmonize ourselves with nature. That strikes us as being sensible. It is not intrinsic to human beings that they should want to push nature around. That is one of the legacies of biblical religion. When we have been given dominion over the heaven and the earth, we have been given a particular intellectual legacy. It takes many centuries to play it out. When it finally is realized, our dominion over heaven, over the earth, comes in the form of modern natural science, well, something most ironic and peculiar happens. The truth turns out not to set us free. The truth, in fact, brings us into bondage to nature. We had hoped at the end of our inquiry into nature, we would get some glyph of God's plan. We had hoped that we would be able to discern the hand of God in the design of nature's patterns. Alas, once we get to Darwin, all we find out is that the world's a big, blind, arbitrary mechanism.
Again, another National Socialist concept. We go to the truth, we look for the truth, and we realize, okay, after all this truth-seeking, we recognize that we aren't exactly free. We are bound to nature, right? We have to follow nature's laws. It's the only law you, by definition, have to follow. It's the only law that not following that is going to harm you way more than any other not following of laws, right? States are temporal. Natural law is eternal, okay? It's very important that you understand that. National Socialist ideology states that understanding of natural law is key because we recognize that we have to follow that and we follow that willingly.
Natural selection isn't the product of God's design, it's just the way things work out. In other words, we lose teleology. Nothing has any purpose anymore. We are no longer what we used to be. Once that happens, we are in the contemporary world. May I suggest that Nietzsche is the first of our contemporaries? That Nietzsche is one of us, because the world in which we live is saturated in these Nietzschean themes. I would be tempted to call this the end of the Sonderstellung. In German, Sonderstellung means other position. And what that means is that for a great deal of time, we had thought that there was nature as it was created by God, trees and bugs and fishes and birds, and then there's a special group of things, people, which have a little spark of the divinity in them, which have been made in God's image, and that makes them totally different from all the other things. It gives to human beings a value that no codfish has. Elk are not nearly as important as human beings because they don't have souls. Human beings have both body and soul. Human beings are made in the image of God, and that's what makes us different. And Nietzsche says, no. He says, we're not made in God's image because there's no God for us to be made in the image of. It turns out that we're really complicated pond scum. Not only are we not made in God's image, but there's no purpose to life. And anyone who thinks that they have discerned a purpose to life are just mistaken. Their imagination is carrying them away.
This is important, and this is where I'll disagree with Nietzsche. To an extent, I agree and disagree, right? So I agree that we are not above all of those other animals, and we're more important somehow intrinsically. However, where I disagree is that there is no purpose in life, okay? The purpose of life, right, and this might seem meaningless in itself, but the purpose of life, by definition, is creation. There's no other purpose you can attribute to life other than creation, right? This is for animals, this is for organisms, this is for human beings, this is for plants. All of the purpose of that plant existing is to reproduce and create more plants, correct? Let's just take, for example, a big oak tree, okay? A big oak tree rains down all of its seeds, okay? And then those seeds get planted into the ground and they create more oak trees, okay? If that oak tree stopped doing that, stopped reproducing its seeds, right? Oak trees would go extinct. Therefore, it no longer has life, right? So to keep life going, the purpose of life, because the purpose of it is to keep it in existence, right? Obviously, right? Like the purpose of trading money in the stock market is to make money, right? So you're trading the money to make the money, right? So the purpose of money then would be to make more money, which is why money is a false thing. It's a false thing to care about, because it's you're caring about a material good that will just keep repeating itself. That's all you're focused on, is the repetition and expansion of something that's material and just agreed upon as valuable. It doesn't actually mean it's valuable, right? It doesn't have any real intrinsic natural value. So the purpose of life, therefore, is to create more life, okay? And again, this goes through all organisms. So this is where I disagree with Nietzsche. He says there's no purpose to life. Well, there is a purpose. That's the natural purpose of life. Then you can attribute your own individual purposes to life, like to be happy or to do this, that, right? All these things are false purposes to an extent, most of them. But the whole purpose of life, because all of life is a cycle, and if you want that cycle to remain, right, for that life to keep going, you have to reproduce. Reproduction and creation repeats the cycle so that life can exist again, and then die, and then repeat, and then die, and then repeat. So the whole purpose of life, by definition, is creation. That's what keeps that cycle constantaneously going and never dying, okay? And that's how species remain on this planet. So if the human species wishes to remain on this planet, just like if the white race specifically wishes to remain on this planet, they must reproduce, right? They must create. And the more they create, the more they reproduce, the more abundant that life will be, right? That's just common sense. There's nothing to argue about those things. Okay, that is coming on to the end of the show. We've got roughly 5 or 6 minutes left of the show. I'm going to outro here, and then we're going to throw some music on for you guys to kind of cool down and enjoy the outro of the stream. Don't forget, folks, if you are on Speak Free Radio, go follow me on all my other platforms. Check me out over there. I'm on Odyssey, Twitter, and GTV. It's at Logos Revealed on all, except for Twitter is at Logos Revealed I. There's an I at the end of it, okay? For the folks on Twitter, we got a lot of viewers over on Twitter. Make sure if you don't already, I'm sure most of you do, but make sure if you don't already, you follow me on Twitter and check out my Odyssey channel. It's very important that you check out my Odyssey. I have a massive archive of all of the streams I've done, all of the interviews. I've interviewed notable people from all over this community, as well as I've done roundtables. I have a series entitled Logos Academy, where I go into really long, in-depth discussions or educational lectures on topics that are very, very, very seldomly discussed in society. So definitely check that out. Make sure you guys go ahead and look at those. We've talked about 9/11. We've talked about the Holocaust. We've talked about Jewish law versus Gentile law. There's a lot of different topics that are considered forbidden or taboo in the modern mainstream. And I go against that grain, and I go into the more educational realm, and I'm not scared to touch into that esoteric sphere. So if you guys are interested in some of that more esoteric information, and it's not conspiracy, like loony kind of stuff where I'm just like, oh, you know, look at all the symbolism and the numbers, and right, I go into actual logical, provable facts that are ground up into this understanding of the world. So it is esoteric, but only esoteric because people do not know about it. Not esoteric because it's some occultish, you know, outer worldly, you know, mystical stuff. It's all based in reality and based in fact, but it's just esoteric because many people do not want you to know about the things that I discuss. So make sure you follow me over on my Odyssey and check those things out. That's that. Yeah, make sure... Again, the collective streams, just follow everything. All of my links are in the scattered around on my profiles on everything. Also, if you guys want to support this show and keep this show going, I hate to have to say this again. We live in this capitalistic society where money is an unfortunate thing that you need to get by. So if you do want to support this channel and keep this educational content flowing, I do unfortunately need something to do that. So all the links to support this channel are in the description below. We again have the crypto wallets. You can support straight through Odyssey, or you can support through Entropy, which will put a little alert up here on the screen and have its own little speech to it. And you can support that way as well. Okay, that's everything for this show. Thank you guys again so much for watching. I really do appreciate it. Viewership was astronomical, especially over on Twitter. The chat on Twitter is like, it's like a cobwebs and dust bunnies, and yeah, it's very odd, but the viewership is good, so I don't know how many people are actually actively listening. I hope it's quite a few, but if you are listening and you haven't been chatting on Twitter, feel free, chat, bring your points into the chat, discuss with me. I'd love to discuss points. I like to discuss opposing views and come to conclusions on things. So thank you guys again so much. That's what I was looking for. Tumbleweeds. I couldn't think of the word. Tumbleweeds. Tumbleweeds. That's what I was thinking of. Thank you guys again so much for watching. I greatly appreciate it. And Urban asks how we can watch on Twitter. You just go on Twitter and you go on like the homepage of your app. Scroll down. It'll refresh the page. And then at the very top, there's like pink live streams that come up at the very top of the page. And I should be up there at the very top. At least on my screen, that is the case right now. I'm coming up with that little pink bar. We have 192 people watching on Twitter, but nobody chatting. So I don't know what that means. I don't know how to take that, but take it for what it is. I don't know if those people are actually watching or not, because the chat room certainly does not echo that number at all. Sacred Saxon, thank you. Hello, brother. Awesome. Okay, that's nice to hear. Yeah, definitely make a Twitter account. Get yourself comfortable on Twitter or situated over there. That's where the mainstream is. That's the way to get the message out there on a grander scale. Just don't get too comfortable, right? Because you know that at any time you can be yanked. So, all right. Thank you guys again so much. I really do appreciate all of the viewers, all of the support lately. And I will be live tomorrow with Frank De Silva at 4 p.m. Eastern. That should be a very interesting show. So make sure you guys do catch that, okay? All right. Thank you guys again for watching. See you guys tomorrow, 4 p.m. Eastern. Have a wonderful night, and enjoy the beautiful weather. Beautiful weather. All right. See you, folks.